Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Beginning of the year, New Hampshire launched a huge new effort aimed at substance abuse. Bolstered with $46 million in federal money, state officials announced an approach they called The Doorway, involving 9 regional hubs where anyone with an addiction problem could walk in and be directed to more focused local services. Now more than half a year in, the system has served more than 4,600 Granite Staters. And today in The Exchange, we check in on this program and what gaps remain. Let's hear from you, especially if you've interacted with The Doorway yourself. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have 3 guests. Peter Fifield is here, clinical mental health counselor, alcohol and drug counselor, and program manager at the Dover Doorway, associated with Wentworth Douglas Hospital. He helps assess people seeking treatment for addiction. And Peter, thank you very much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Also with us, John Burns, director of the SOS Recovery Community Organization in Stratford County and the Seacoast, with recovery centers in Dover, Rochester, and Hampton. John works with the hub at Wentworth Douglas Hospital and is himself in long-term recovery. And John, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you.
And also with us, Tim Work, director of Substance Use Disorders Grant Making for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. He also serves on the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment and Recovery. The Charitable Foundation is an NHPR underwriter. And Tim Rourke, welcome back to you, too.
Thank you, Laura.
So it's worth remembering, Tim, just the scope of this crisis that this whole Doorway project is aimed at. Just remind us, please, Tim, of the enormous toll that opioid addiction and other addictions have had on our state in recent years.
Sure. And so, you know, we've been in what we refer to as the opioid crisis for a little over 10 years now. And I think there's a mix of both good news and a long way to go news in terms of how the epidemic is continuing to impact the state. In 2018, we had 471 people die of a drug overdose. That was slightly down from 2017.
Still, that's more than one person a day.
Exactly. And as of this month, in 2019, we've already had 212 confirmed overdoses that have been confirmed by the medical examiner, while there are still 56 that are under investigation where an overdose is suspected, but it's not yet confirmed. So we are not, while it seems like there's been a little bit of a decrease in terms of deaths, we're not out of the woods even remotely. There are some highlights, I think. Over the last 5 to 7 years, there's been a 5-fold increase in treatment access and recovery support access attributable to the gentlemen who are going to be on our show today, talking about the good work that they're doing and increasing in insurance access. But it is important to remember the damage this does to individuals and families. And sort of the latest economic analysis still puts the cost to New Hampshire alone of its struggle with the addiction epidemic at over $2 billion a year. And that's lost worker productivity, healthcare costs, public safety costs. And that's only financial, let alone the cascading ripple effect that's happening in the lives of individuals and families around the state.
So personal toll, economic toll on the healthcare system. It's really, we've heard about children who have parents who are in the throes of addiction, an impact on our education system and an impact on future generations.
Exactly. And we're seeing a lot of changes that are being done in early childhood centers and schools to adapt to the profile of young people who are obviously coming in impacted. We're seeing issues play out also in our homeless shelter system, where substance use is impacting the homeless community. So the broad array of services and supports that help kids and families in New Hampshire are all impacted by this issue.
And just very quickly, Tim, and then we'll get more detailed descriptions from our other 2 guests, but very briefly, just describe for us this hub and spoke system. What does that mean?
Sure. So the model actually comes, many states have adopted a model of this nature. The closest to us is Vermont. The idea is, you know, one of the biggest challenges with someone with a substance use disorder is that moment where they decide they're ready for help and they don't know where to go. So Hub and Spoke is designed to try to solve a problem that I think in the rest of the healthcare system, we just automatically understand. My doctor gives me a diagnosis, I get referred to a specialist, off I go. That doesn't hold true in addiction. So the purpose of a hub and spoke model is to try and create a more streamlined inroad into whatever services the individual needs, and to try and address issues of equity and access, very specifically in a state like ours that's rural. Can we get people help if they want it close to home, rather than forcing folks to have to travel great distances to access care? And in a state like ours, where treatment has been limited for so long, there's really an effort through this hub and spoke model to try and create equitable access in every region of the state up front.
So, Peter, you're involved with this system as a so-called hub, as Tim described. So what does that mean for you on a daily basis? What do you do for people who walk into your doors?
Well, it depends, to be completely honest. Our goal is to assess and connect individuals to treatment. So we follow the American Society of Addiction Medicine protocols for ASAM level of care. And there's, you know, from 3.4.0 all the way down to 0.5. And an individual will come in. We have a walk-in service, so it's 8 to 5. One of the doorways, actually, to Nashua and Manchester, I believe, are 7 to 11. The rest of them are open around 8 to 5. And the walk-in access, as Tim was mentioning, is paramount because, you know, motivation for recovery is often very fleeting. So when an individual walks in and they're driving by, they're at home and they say, "Mom, Dad, I need help. Friend, I need help." Or they call 211. Whatever the access point is, they can just walk in and get connected. At that point, we check them in. It's a very typical process. And we have a screening tool where we assess what their needs are, not just with recovery, but with all of their sort of social determinants, if you would. We assess for housing needs, work needs, child care needs, all of that, because the doorway is very much so. And because we're trying to understand that recovery isn't just not using. Recovery is a long-term process. So how do we take this funnel approach where they're now at our location and do our best to coordinate whatever level of care they need after that assessment? The difficult part, to be completely honest, is sort of is the access component, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later. Because if an individual does walk in and they're ready right now, but they have a two-week wait to get into treatment, then you can see the gap there in terms of them actually getting connected to a treatment source.
Oh, that must be so frustrating for you. So someone walks in, they say, "Peter, I am ready to be done with this addiction problem." You say, "Great, let's assess what you need. Let's assess where you're at." And then you have to figure out where to send this person. And sometimes there's a place and sometimes there isn't.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the positive things with that, we try to take a positive twist here when we can. At least the individual is connected, right? They can still come in. We're not necessarily, none of the doorways are hangouts, but they are a place that you could do work towards recovery. So they can come in, do phone calls. They can hang out, get a cup of coffee, and just talk to a care coordinator. We can connect them. We work directly with SOS and their coaching offerings, and we work a lot with them, connect them back to the coach. We can do a lot of things in that moment. And realistically, a 3 to 4 day wait to kind of get the individual collected and their life ready to enter treatment is a fair enough wait, but the 2 week point, we tend to lose people to care.
Okay, so I want to bring you in, John, on SOS, and you're a spoke. Peter's a hub, you're a spoke. But very quickly, Peter, you mentioned that you're open 8 to 5. Mm-hmm. I mean, anybody, you know, illness often happens at night. Things often happen at night on the weekend. Anybody who has kids knows the fever always spikes at midnight. So what about that 8 to 5?
Well, it's interesting because there is talk about 24/7. And I've been doing a lot of thinking about this. And at 3 in the morning, someone comes in, still, what are we going to do with them?
Right.
Right. So
the doorway is closed.
We need a spoke then to connect them with at 3 in the morning. It's not just the doorways be open 24/7. So.
Well, and we do have links to the doorway program on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And access to help is available by calling 211 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The doorway, by the way, is an NHPR underwriter. So the hub is where Peter is. John, you are a spoke, director of the SOS Recovery Community Organization. From your perspective, how is this whole new program going, especially someone who has struggled with addiction yourself?
Well, I think from a high level, I mean, we're certainly making progress. and so I don't want to be all negative about what we're doing right now. But likewise, we've lost over 1,500 people in the last 3 years. And nationally, we all, there's probably a lot of football fans listening. For those of you who might have watched the Patriots this weekend, think about that stadium being completely filled to capacity and everybody being killed.
Wow.
That's happening every year, except the numbers are higher than that. And that's solely from overdose deaths. That doesn't even include alcohol. So when I look at this, the problem, both statewide and nationally, is we have less of a drug problem. We have a drug policy problem. And that is that we still continue to punish people, and we still continue to create policies where we dump more money into law enforcement efforts and corrections efforts than we do treating people with a health problem and being respectful of their human rights.
You still see that going on?
Well, I think if you look here in New Hampshire alone, we have 13 recovery centers. Altogether, they receive 50% of one program, which is called, used to be Granite Hammer, but they softened the marketing and turned it into Granite Shield, which they say is designed to go after dealers. It's primarily going after people who are using drugs. And that program, rather than getting them help, is still arresting them up, while at the same time, we hear talking points of we can't arrest our way out of it. When I look at what the recovery centers are doing for work in this state, when we have 13 of them, if we had 3 million instead of 1.5, I think we could make a much bigger impact than what we're making with a silly program designed to do drug sweeps and arrest people and put them into jail cells where they're not getting the help they need.
I've heard you say, John, that this new system is a navigation system with no capacity. Talk a little bit about that, please. The idea that, okay, you've got the doorway, you can come in, bravo, you're ready to quit, but then what's there for you?
Right, and so it becomes that, which came first, the chicken or the egg? So I think we do need a navigation system, and we certainly need the assessments. But at the same time, there's not much resources going into the spokes, and that's a real problem. The fact that we have a system that's only open from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., that's not open on weekends, tells a story of we're not taking the lives that are being lost seriously, and that because if we were, there's no way we wouldn't have 24/7 access.
So if you're ready for recovery at midnight, calling 211 isn't good enough. You need to walk in somewhere and see a physical human being.
Right. If you're going into, shock from diabetes, you need instant care. If you're having a heart attack, you get instant care. If you overdose, you go into a hospital, and in most cases, you get a list of phone numbers.
Can you share as much as you're comfortable, John, of your own story and how that informs your work today?
So I'm a person in long-term recovery. I think I'm more informed by the fact that I have a daughter who has struggled. So she's 22 now. She actually just started another recovery process, but again, because she was arrested on warrants last week. So much of it is informed by my experiences trying to get my daughter help.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I mean, I've taken her, a perfect example is here in New Hampshire, I've taken her to safe stations 3 times and the doorways each of those times. Not once did she get treatment out of those, except for the very last time, which her mother took her. And that was only after I threw a temper tantrum because she had been turned away. There was no beds at safe stations. The doorways didn't have anything. In fact, they sent her over to a hospital. And so I threw a fit. And at that point, she was able to access she got some help from Harbor Homes, but we had to take her from Manchester down to Nashua only to make that happen. So the system is fundamentally broken. And it's not for a lack of intent. I don't think there's any one person to point fingers at. I think what we need is more serious discussions about solutions. And so I don't want to sit here and just fire away the negativity at it, because I think when I see some of the conflict that's gone on recently between Manchester and the state, that really frustrates me when people are dying, that we're not having more serious discussions of let's come to a solution on this. Yes, we do need safe stations. But when I look at the program of safe stations, again, we've lowered our level. So what people need is they need medical detox when they need it.
Well, and we're going to talk
to... So the very system is created as one that is at some level a glorified homeless shelter, which is great, and I'm not bashing that safe stations model. I think we should have one in every county in the state. But it's not the level of care that people need when they need it.
Yeah, your experience shows, and I'm sure the experience of many other people, more is needed. And I want to let listeners know that we are going to be talking to Chief Goonan in Manchester about safe stations and the role that it's played. So, Tim, you were nodding while John is talking. So, in a way, okay, great, we have these doorways, but what's beyond the doorway, so to speak? It doesn't sound like there's enough there.
There isn't. And I think that's, you know, Chief Justice Nadeau from the Superior Court often says, you know, when it comes to addiction, we walked into the forest without a compass for 30 years. And so the idea that we're just going to find our way out almost overnight is not realistic. And I do think that, you know, even when we talk about the doorways, and this is true as well as we look at safe stations and other types of solutions that answer this question, I'm ready for recovery, where do I start? That's all it does. I think that there is still a need to think about spokes. Those services remain they've had increases in funding. We have increased insurance access so people can access care. But I'll quote Peter, who I heard speak in an event last week, who said, you know, when the doorways do their job well, when Safe Stations does their job well, wait lists grow. And so that's where I think there has to be a continuing push to really understand the profile of who's coming in seeking care, what their circumstances are, and then really look at what are the specific services, the spoke services, the direct interventions that are needed for folks in New Hampshire and make those available, again, within some reasonable distance from where they live. This, in many ways, is an entirely new population accessing the healthcare system, because we've treated addiction as a moral failing or some other issue.
Or a criminal issue,
and not as a healthcare issue. We do not have, in many instances, a healthcare system that many of these individuals have ever meaningfully impacted or interacted with. And so I think part of what we are discovering, both through the work of the chief in Manchester and his team, through the work of the doorways, is understanding the complex needs of a patient system that's never interacted with the healthcare system and really becoming acutely aware of levels of care that are simply not available in enough capacity or not available within their community. And that is, I think, a place where we need to continue to think about. And to me, it's not as if, while John talks about we need to think and discuss solutions, it's not as if we don't know what they are. And I know oftentimes, you know, we don't want to talk about money, but this is actually about money. We build capacity for things happen. We have 13 recovery centers in part because there was a decision to put resources into the operation of recovery centers. We have these doorways. We now have places people can go to start their recovery journey, in part because there was money. I think that we have to continue to think about how do we finance a healthcare system that can provide the fullest array of services at the moment the patient is ready, wherever the patient is. And that is something where we have a lot more work to do.
Well, coming up, as I said, we will talk to Manchester's police chief, Daniel Goonan. His safe station model has been lauded, copied, and we'll start taking your questions and comments. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More on the doorway, the hub and spoke system in New Hampshire that is trying to reduce the state's addiction problem. We'll talk in just a moment. Stay with us.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, The Doorway, the new statewide program for people seeking addiction treatment. With a huge federal grant, the system got started early in the year. We're finding out now how it's working, where the gaps are, and we'd like to hear from you, of course. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. Peter Fifield is here, clinical mental health counselor, alcohol and drug counselor, and program manager at the Dover Doorway, associated with Wentworth Douglas Hospital. John Burns is with us, director of the SOS Recovery Community Organization in Stafford County and the Seacoast, along with Tim Rourke, director of substance use disorders grant making for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, and also serving on the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment and Recovery. And gentlemen, with us now on the phone is Daniel Goonan, chief of the Manchester Fire Department, where he oversees the city's Safe Station program, 10 fire stations that have served as intake centers for addicts since 2016. Chief Goonan, I know you're a busy guy. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me anytime.
So remind us, if you could please, Chief, what a Safe Station is, the addiction outreach effort that your department began a few years ago.
Well, Safe Station is, like you said, was rolled out in May of 2016, in a fire department response to what was happening with the crisis that we were facing. At that time, it was mostly opiates. So we opened all of our fire departments, all of their doors, or 10 fire stations, to 24/7 to anybody needing help. And it's something kind of came naturally to us because, we've been doing this for about 150 years, being in your local neighborhood. So what we're trying to do is just capture that one moment where somebody feels that they could use the help most, whether it's, they hit rock bottom, or they have some sort of epiphany, or their parents convinced them to finally seek some help. So that's really what we did, and we've become a pretty kind of a natural, I think, access point, and it's a great way, I think, for the fire departments to step up and help during this, crisis that we've been seeing.
Right, and everybody knows where the fire department is, and
that's
people
true.
Feel comfortable with firefighters. They're the guys that save you from the burning building, guys and
right.
gals, I should say. So when someone comes into the fire station, Chief, and says, "Help, I'm ready," what happens next?
What we do is do a triage. What we've kind of developed here, and I think it was easy for us to develop, is just a stigma-free zone, low threshold, where you treat people with a handshake and just basically human beings. So once we do that triage, one of a couple things can happen. People are very sick when they come in here. It's the sickest of the sick and really the most needy. People are coming in here with, mental health problems. They're coming here with, physical issues. So when we do the triage, we can, one of kind of two things can happen. They can go, they're kind of deemed healthy enough to take the next step, where at that point they go to Granite Pathways, which is part of the Doorway system. If they're too sick to make that next move, whether it's medical or psychological. If it's psychological, we can call the MCRT team at Manchester Mental Health, and they'll help us, or they'll go right to one of our hospitals. They're not lost in the hospitals because we give them, right now, we tell them to keep your pink slip, and the hospital emergency rooms work very closely with us, and they will get you to the next step, which is either Pathways or the Farnham Center. The Farnham Center has 16 beds that are stabilization beds to keep people there short-term until they can get to the most appropriate level of service.
So you're kind of operating like a hub, Chief Goonan.
Yeah, I guess we're kind of a hub to the hub. I mean, if my opinion is if they didn't have the firehouse to make these, these triage moves here, the hub would be completely overwhelmed with people that are extremely sick and definitely too sick to be speaking to a recovery coach or a LADAC.
Where are the people coming to you for help coming from, Chief Goonan? Do you know?
Well, 50% come from from the city of Manchester, and the rest are from outside the city, and in fact, outside the Doorway's catchment area.
Wow!
Right now, I think we have the two big ones are the Dover area, about 13%, and Laconia is around 10%, and then we've probably, the last count was you know, 180, 190 other communities from all over the state, and, you know, probably seven other states also.
So what does that suggest to you, Chief, that these people are coming from all over?
Well, I think, you know, I'm very hopeful that, you know, the doorways will build up the, you know, kind of the back end of this. What I'm hearing from some of the other doorways, and I do call them often, is that, you know, there's the services aren't quite there up in some of the other areas. That's what I feel. Services aren't there, or that they don't have any temporary shelter, temporary, you know, stabilization. And you're seeing that here in Manchester, where we're really overwhelmed with our homeless population. I've never seen it like this before.
Mm. You know, Chief Goonan, hang on if you could, please, for a moment,
sure.
Because I think Peter Fifield wants to jump in. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes. No, I think we were listed, the Dover area, as the highest offender in terms of, however, the direct referrals from doorways are not going to safe stations. Individuals will come in. And they'll say, I'm going to do this, and we do our best. You know, ultimately, we have no ability to restrain an individual from their individual choice. And we can advise them not to do such, and they have a choice to go to Manchester anyway.
But why do you think that's the case? Clearly, if someone comes into the doorway in Dover, you're not going to send them to safe stations in Manchester because it's fulfilling sort of the same role. But why do you suppose so many people from Dover are going all the way to Manchester? It's not close.
It's not, instead of
coming into the doorway.
No, well, they have a place to stay, right? Or in their mind's eye, they have a place to be, a safe place for the night. And Chief Goonan's absolutely correct in terms of resources locally. I have to challenge the statement of the doorway's responsibility for building those. I think it's a community responsibility. I mean, the doorways are connected to hospitals. Hospitals cannot pull the weight. One hospital can't pull the weight of building all the resources in Stratford and Rockingham County, right? You can't do that. So it really is a community response to building the resources.
John, what do you think?
Well, I think, so I was asked by members of DHHS, they approached me and they said, do you really think doorways are sending people to safe stations? And I said, no. I said, we're the only agency in Stratford County that's open 7 days a week. And we're the only agency that's open 24/7 for the police departments to call us through our community access. I'm sending them to safe stations. So we have a very robust recovery support system with peer recovery supports in Stratford County. We had over 1,000 visits last month. And the only thing that's available to give people who are homeless, who have no place to go, a chance at getting into a treatment is through safe stations when it's after 5 p.m. and it's a Saturday or a Sunday. So you're damn right I'm sending them there. You know, we take them up there. We don't leave them there generally because the last thing we want is them on the streets of Manchester instead. So I think that's why you're seeing higher numbers from Dover and Rochester areas, because you know, we've built the trust in the community as being willing and able to go bend over backwards to get people the help they need and working closely with the doorway. So the people come to us when they're put on a waiting list at the doorway, and we transport them to wherever we can find a bed as fast as we possibly can before that window shuts.
Wow. Chief Goonan, so the fact that you guys are open 24/7, everybody knows where the fire department is, you know, that's part of the issue here. What does that say to you about what the rest of the system should do?
Well, I do agree. I mean, one of the big things I think would, you know, one of the things that could take the pressure off us is to, you know, have the doorways kind of a little bit more like the doorways here in Manchester. We've proven that this is a great access point. There's no doubt about that. It's been studied. It's been studied by federal agencies. It's been studied by Dartmouth College, that this is just a good way to get people into the system. Now, the 24-hour thing is you're absolutely right. These doorways really need to be open 24 hours. Two-on-one doesn't work. You know, two-on-one is just, I guess you can call it another access point, but it's really a switchboard. So to say that you're going to call 211 in the middle of the night and get anything is really not right. And what you need to do, and I think that the state is kind of heading in that direction, is that if the doorways are open, you know, 24 hours a day for people, you know, seeking, you know, some help, you know, and that we can develop some stabilization units around the state, I think connecting that with a couple of the fire departments, like, say, Dover, say, Laconia, maybe Littleton, you know, would have a statewide safe station program. And like I said, it's been proven to work here. I can't imagine that it couldn't work anywhere else. And I think we're pushing the state, sometimes kicking and screaming in that direction, but it makes sense. I mean, if they did this at the beginning of the year, if they did this, if they looked at the system that we have here and the system that we've been working on for 3 years, and we've changed it and we've pitched and we're trying to, you know, make this the best we can, if they just followed this template, I think we would be in a better place right now.
Let's go to the phones, all of you. Lots of people who want to join our conversation. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And from Manchester, Cameron is calling in. Hi, Cameron. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
I'm such a big fan. How
Good.
Are you this morning?
Fine.
Good. So I'm just doing my best right now. I'm a recovering spice addict, alcoholic, and drug addict. And I went to the Elliott ER the last two nights to let them know that I've been feeling hypomanic. And unfortunately, the staff there doesn't even know, like, what the annex is. You know, the annex where they send the loony people.
So the annex is a place where people are sent, Cameron, when they are feeling like they're not in control?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, if you're psychotic or you're going to hurt yourself, they kind of just whisk you into there.
So
I asked them about going to detox, and unfortunately, the doctors there don't have such good bedside manner.
So what do you think about this whole new system that we have getting put in place right now, Cameron? Sounds like there's still some mismatches, if I could put it that way.
Correct. So my congressman, Chris Pappas, and also my Senator Gene Shaheen, I actually met back in November at the Cory Booker kickoff rally. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned to them the discrepancy that, thanks to the Trump administration, all poor people are having. Trump changed when he came into office and was inaugurated. He immediately changed the federal income guidelines for Social Security disability insurance.
Sure.
And so right now I have something called SLMB. It's SLMB, and it's through the Department of Health and Human Services of New Hampshire. But the caveat is that is $134 a month, and I only make $1,078 a month.
Wow.
So as you know, that's like a really big cut. That's almost like, that is more than 10% of my income.
Wow.
Right,
so lots of issues. And boy, Cameron, I'm glad you called. I mean, one, this call, Tim, is showing us, you know, a lot of the gaps that still exist in this system.
It is. And Cameron, just thank you for calling and congratulations on your recovery, whether it's 24 hours or 24 minutes. And, you know, I think all of us at the table here are wishing you well and encouragement to keep seeking that recovery support and assistance that you need. You know, a couple of things that I think are worth mentioning. I think Cameron's story also highlights another important point about the state of our state as it comes to addiction, which is that the profile of those struggling is changing. And we've talked about it before. It's not just an opioid epidemic. Over the past weekend, the chief was dealing with about 20 overdoses or reactions due to spice exposure in the homelessness population. We are seeing an increase of individuals presenting with methamphetamine abuse, which is a completely different patient profile with different needs, different challenges than those with opioids. So again, this is an addiction crisis, not just opioid specific. I also think, as Cameron was talking, he raises two other good points. The first is that, you know, the doorways is an attempt as well to try and create, at least in the ones that are co-located with hospitals, an effort, a resource to deal with folks in the midst of that crisis that's not in the emergency room. But meanwhile, there is a lot of work being done, and we at the foundation are co-funding with the Endowment, a learning collaborative of emergency rooms, to really help emergency rooms think more creatively around how to address those who come in behavioral health crisis, whether it's mental illness or substance use. Because again, that's not something that many of the hospital emergency rooms have been well equipped to manage.
Sounds like that from Cameron's experience.
Absolutely, absolutely.
He's pointing out what you're saying.
And the third piece that he referenced again is, I think it is important for us to remember that even if we develop treatment and recovery supports, that's not enough. You know, what Cameron's talking about is living wage, having access to a job, safe housing, all of those other things. And that's the other opportunity that the doorways present is not just, can we find you care for this illness, but let's understand you as a whole person. And can we begin to align other resources and supports that we know are imperative to people finding long-term recovery?
Chief Goonan, I have one last question for you, please. And again, we appreciate your time. Cameron mentioned, and thank you, Cameron, for the call, that he was addicted to spice. How did this weekend's spike in spice overdoses affect your city's overall attempts to combat addiction?
Well, spice is, it really didn't, spice is a dangerous drug also, and it really didn't surprise me that we had a bump up like that this weekend. I've been talking about spice that's really ravaging the homeless community, and it's been going on for an awful long time. The difference this weekend was that particular chemical makeup of the spice. It could be just one dealer that came up from New York or Massachusetts that had a bad batch, and people were acting a little more aggressively than usual. But it really didn't, it's would have that many spice overdoses anyway. But people were presenting with like an opiate like reaction, as opposed to like this psychotic reaction, and people were just running from us. So that was the only difference that I saw. But this is something I've been talking about for a long time. But I got to tell you, though, just Tim's comments. Now, Tim has been, I met Tim 3 years ago, and those guys, his foundation has been critical in the Safe Station program and the direction that we've been going in Manchester. He's an extremely smart guy, and he's a great resource to us. But he is absolutely right. This is an all-of-the-above crisis. We're seeing so much methamphetamine, so much spice. It's, and when we talk about the opiates, it's almost like the opiates have passed us by, and we've got a new, drugs are just poly substances. We're just, when people come in and I talk to a lot of people in the Safe Station program, I kind of miss the good old fashioned alcoholics only or opiate addicts, because we have things you can treat. We have medications. But when someone comes in and says, yeah, I'm an opiate addict, but I also use methamphetamines and spice and alcohol and all the above, you're dealing with a different, a different character here. And it's really, really, changing what we see every day.
Wow. Complicated. Chief, thank you very much. I'm hoping we'll be able to talk to you again. Thanks for your time today.
Awesome. Yep. Anytime.
Daniel Goonan is chief of the Manchester Fire Department. And coming up, we're going to look more at this new hub and spoke system called The Doorway with a North Country doctor on what The Doorway looks like in rural parts of the state. And we'll keep taking your calls, questions, comments. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also comment on Facebook. You can tweet us. More in a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
A sustaining member of NHPR because
I really feel like their journalism is fair and balanced, and I need that in my life.
And it's not just what's going on nationally, but it's very much rooted
in what's going on in our neck of the woods.
Sustaining NHPR is, in effect, sustaining my ability to be a more thoughtful person in the world.
And if you appreciate NHPR, you should be supporting it.
Support the news you trust and the programs you love at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, an update on New Hampshire's new addiction treatment system known as The Doorway. We've been hearing about how this hub-and-spoke system works with 9 regional hubs and then spokes that are supposed to provide appropriate, specific treatment more locally. We've been hearing about some of the gaps in the system about 9 months in when it was first set up, and we've been hearing from you, Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With us now from the North Country is Dr. Lars Nielsen, Chief Medical Officer at Weeks Medical Center in Lancaster. Dr. Nielsen is also the medical director for two North Country hubs, run by Androscoggin Valley Hospital in Berlin and Littleton Hospital. And Dr. Nielsen, a big welcome. Thank you for being with us on The Exchange this morning.
I'm happy to be with you.
What's your role, Dr. Nielsen, in this whole doorway hub and spoke system?
So I am the medical director for the two North Country hubs. So I'm involved with the planning and implementation of the programs, which include intake, access to case management services, access to counseling, as well as prescribing. I'm also the lead prescriber for the Littleton Hub.
Wow. So someone walks in. What do you do for them immediately, Dr. Nielsen, and then over the longer term? Just kind of walk us through a typical situation there.
So one of the prime concepts of the hub system is easy access to care, easy and prompt. So people walk in, they are seen by a recovery coach, who usually is also the front desk person. They come in, they would set up an appointment with the case manager, would go through a pretty lengthy intake form called the JIPRA, and I don't know what that acronym stands for. And part of that assessment would be, are they actively withdrawing? Are they actively using? So that then that information can be sent to the prescriber, who would evaluate that information, if possible, see them briefly face to face, but otherwise send in a prescription we call a bridge, which bridges them until their next access to care.
So when you say a prescription, Dr. Nielsen, do you mean Suboxone to help reduce the cravings of withdrawal or the bad feelings associated with withdrawal? Is that what you mean?
So, yes. Suboxone is one of the medications that we use, and Suboxone is a combination of buprenorphine, which stops the urges and withdrawal symptoms, and naloxone, which helps to prevent abuse because it makes inactivates the drug if it's injected intravenously.
And
we also use a medication called naltrexone, which is also helps with alcohol abuse. And that's available both as an oral and as an injectable form.
How much in this new system that we've been describing this hour, Dr. Nielsen, how much do you see the concerns or the realities of rural New Hampshire reflected in how this system is set up?
Well, one of the big problems, of course, is distances. And, you know, we have between the Littleton Hub and the, you know, upper reaches of Pittsburgh, New Hampshire is, you're talking 60, 70 miles.
Wow.
Without good roads. And a lot of people have big issues with transportation. We don't have a robust public transportation network up here. We do have some buses, and there is a organization, Rural Transportation Center, I think. We do have some taxis. But a lot of people, because of their economic situations, don't own a car. And, of course, because of prior activities, often don't have a driver's license.
Oh, sure. If you've been caught driving under the influence, you get your license taken away. So then you can't even drive to the recovery center.
Not legally.
Yeah, not legally. Exactly. I mean, if you had sort of the governor's ear or the federal government's ear, since they're funding a lot of these programs, what would you say, Dr. Nielsen, that is needed to, you know, get your system in great shape?
Well, we need more resources. And we are, you know, besides the transportation and funding, we're critically short of prescribers, behavioral health therapists, as well as case workers. And ideally, we would have access 24/7 to recovery coaches, to people who could help when somebody presents in crisis. We really do not have a network adequate to provide call. We do have some availability during the day, during working hours, but nights and weekends, there really isn't much services available.
Dr. Nielsen, thank you very much for being with us, and we will touch base with you again. We are planning another show focused on the particular challenges combating addiction in rural New Hampshire. So we'll talk to you again, but thank you for now.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
That's Dr. Lars Nielsen, as we heard, Chief Medical Officer at Weeks Medical Center in Lancaster, also working with two North Country hubs, Androscoggin Valley Hospital in Berlin and Littleton Hospital. And gentlemen, I'd like to go back to our listeners, but very quickly, he mentioned something, Peter, that I'm guessing you're struggling with as well at your hub, and that's just staff shortages. There just aren't enough people to fill these jobs, even if you did have the money to pay them.
We've had a significant issue with staffing. We actually are very fortunate in the terms of our initial staffing. We were able to ramp up with some very qualified, amazing clinicians and care coordinators and staff members all together. The issue is once we expand, it's stealing from Peter to pay Paul at this point. You know, they have to leave somewhere because there's very few new clinicians coming in. The licensure process is absolutely monstrous in terms of
monstrous.
Sort of,
you know, really? We did a whole show on this a couple years ago. It hasn't gotten better?
There could have been improvements, but it's not visible. How about that? So getting a license is very difficult. There's insurance regulations. Sometimes there's hurdles in terms of can an intern work at your entity and still be a viable source of income. Interns are a wonderful source they're just a wonderful resource that aren't always usable in larger entities such as hospital systems and primary care. One of the things I just want to pull this back a little bit in terms of resources. The workforce issue is definitely, without a doubt, we're in the middle of that. And I just spoke at, a local university here in the state, and they're working on programs, minors and certificates towards substance use addiction, because you don't necessarily need a master's licensed alcohol and drug counselor license to treat someone with substance use disorder. You could be a PhD, you can be a psychiatrist, you can be a social worker. You just need specialized training in substance use disorder. So I love the fact that programs like that are popping up, because we don't only need to sort of need a new influx of new workers, we need to be able to train the workforce that is already existing to treat this subset of symptoms.
Here's an email from Grace in Henniker, who says, why don't we focus more on the how and why people get started on opioid addiction and more aggressively work to deter those first steps? Grace says it's easier to thwart addiction by deterring people from taking an addictive substance in the first place. John, I'd love to throw that to you.
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of evidence related to trauma right now. So we know that SAMHSA estimates that at 55% or so of people struggling with substance use disorder have a history of trauma. I would suggest it's probably closer to 90% based on what we see, and we continue to see research in that area. So I think an important effort that would be well spent in this state is prevention efforts that revolve around adverse childhood experience surveys, and building resilience programs that the entire community can wrap themselves around with mentoring and parenting education. And those are evidence-based to show not only for substance use disorder, but mental health and public health as far as chronic health problems with pulmonary and cardiac disease. There's all kinds of stuff. It goes way beyond substance use disorder and mental illness. And so I think and I'm not seeing a lot of that right now. And we really need to put a focus on it as a state to build some community resilience programs, because we know that people with trauma can survive that and they can thrive, but we have to put resilience efforts in place. We have to have a solution in place, and it's a hell of a lot cheaper than treatment. So I would welcome that, because right now people struggling with trauma have literally no resources. I mean, my daughter has struggled with trauma and mental illness in addition to her addiction, and she's often put on 5-month waiting lists to get a one-on-one counseling, which may or may not be somebody who has any experience with trauma. So it's mind-boggling to see
a 5-month waiting list. Excuse me for interrupting. A 5-month waiting list just to see a mental health provider.
That's pretty common for people on Medicaid in the state.
Well, okay. So since John mentioned Medicaid, let's talk about that, Tim, in terms of both having enough mental health counselors available to see people like John's daughter, and also finding enough people to staff, you know, some of the resources that Dr. Nielsen is working on.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the workforce challenges, and John's comment alludes to it, we have a workforce crisis in our healthcare system. not just in the behavioral health system. So our lack of specialists with a substance abuse credential sort of pales in comparison to lack of workforce in almost any healthcare specialty you could imagine right now. And so there's a real challenging conversation around how do we just build New Hampshire's workforce. We have very limited access to psychiatry. Almost no access to adolescent or pediatric psychiatry. So I think there are, again, as we think about, to Peter's point, it's not just about MLADACs or specialists who are designed or who have credentials specifically to treat addiction, but all these other ancillary supports. I do think that, you know, one of the other big barriers that we face, while we can work in the college and university system, create those career pathways, retrain existing workers, we are hamstrung by inappropriately low Medicaid rates. We have some of the lowest Medicaid rates of any state in the country. There was work in the last budget process to increase Medicaid rates. Because rates are so low, it's very difficult to do salary adjustments. It's very difficult for providers, treatment providers, and others to even operate because those rates don't really cover true cost. So there was an effort to increase Medicaid rates in the budget process. The original, I think, ask of the advocacy community was around a 60% increase. The increase that was included in the final version of the budget was a 3% increase, which is not nearly enough, but at least a step forward. Of course, the budget is in continuing resolution right now. And so in the absence of a new budget, those rates have not yet come to pass. And so still, Medicaid rates are an enormous issue and an enormous barrier to building out capacity to provide services to folks in the state of New Hampshire.
Let's go back to our listeners. And we have an email here from Karen in Laconia who says, I applaud the hub and spoke system for all the good work they do, but it seems as if most services are geared toward young people. My understanding is that a significant number of people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s or older have become addicted to opioids through attempts at pain management. Karen says older folks are more likely to have medical issues. I had a family member in his 50s for whom it was terribly difficult to find treatment due to his breathing issues and to the fact that he had Medicaid for insurance. My question, how does the doorway system address age-related needs? Do you want to talk about that,
yeah,
Peter?
No, that's absolutely a wonderful observation. Thank you. There, in terms of the demographic or the profile of an individual that's struggling with some use disorder, it's very different between alcohol use disorder and an opiate use disorder, for instance. The average age for opiate use disorder, at least in our hub, is about 30. Where the average age for an alcohol use disorder is 45, 50. It's up in the upper range. So you have an individual that's 55, 60 joining an intensive outpatient program with 18 other 20-year-olds, right? It's an effective place. It's an effective treatment model. However, the makeup of the group might not be as effective for that individual. And specialized training, any sort of like geriatric-focused substance use disorder, I don't know of any that take a Medicaid option, that's for sure. And specialized in the state, I don't know of any specialized treatment locally in the state for that specific age group.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned people coming in for alcohol abuse. So it is worth clarifying, and Tim, I'll turn to you real quickly, that people coming in through the doorway aren't just seeking help for opioid addiction, even though that's what sort of sparked this big federal grant.
Yes, and I have to give both the doorways and the Department of Health and Human Services a lot of credit for really trying to be intentional to make sure that the public understands that this is not a service that is only available to those with an opioid use disorder. And I think as well recognizing that the vast majority of people who have an opioid use disorder probably are using other substances as well.
As the chief told us.
They're poly-using, right? Yeah. So yes, I think the doorways are designed and the intention is that folks who have a substance use problem, regardless of the drug, are able to attempt to seek care through those doorways.
By the way, we did ask for someone from DHHS to join us today. They were unable to provide anybody. We also learned that the state's opioid coordinator has left. There's now an interim person in that role. Let's take one more call if we could. This is Michelle in Tilton. Go ahead, Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi. I just happen to be in the Lakes region, one of the recovery community organization directors that happens to be a family resource center as well. And there is work being done around adverse childhood experiences within the family resource center system. We just set a facilitating organization this year, and things are slowly moving forward in that area. But as far as the hubs, we work really pretty well with the director of our hub, Corey Gately. She's awesome. But the thing is, when this was rolled out, there were still no resources for things like transportation, housing. And for us, the only treatment center is Farnham in our area. It's in Franklin, but their detox center is in Manchester. And with our hubs closed at 5 o'clock and on weekends, just as John was saying, those are the resources for us in our region, is to go to Manchester. So I'm until we have, like, the housing piece, the temporary housing piece addressed, because the only shelters we can refer to from our area is the McKenna House in Concord, the Terry House in Laconia, the Bridge House up in Plymouth, but none of these shelters are wet shelters. None of them are.
Wet and shelters means someone with using alcohol or other substances can come in.
Actively using substances. And so one of the things we see, they go through the doorway and then they come out, they have no place to sleep. They catch more criminal charges because they're breaking into places to stay safe, especially in the winter. And that's where my concern is, like, growing. We are seeing such an increase in homeless individuals. Sometimes we're finding them sleeping on our back docks. Sometimes they're out in the woods in a tent. Sometimes they're in a car in a parking lot. And this is not going to work through the winter. And with Manchester's housing crisis already exploding, like, I am very concerned about where are we going to end up in the coming months.
Well, Michelle, thank you for calling, and I'll let you go because we're nearing the end of the hour. But all of you, I think you're just going to have to come back because there's a lot that we didn't talk about today. Michelle, basically John was reiterating what you said earlier, that, you know, we've got the doorway, that's the doors of the doorway, the hubs, but there's a lot of work left to be done on the spoke. So kind of sounds like what you said earlier.
Yeah, and real quickly, the one thing that's not being focused on at all is harm reduction and keeping people alive with syringe service programs. In fact, the city of Manchester reallocated $80,000 that could have been used for syringe service programs in the city because they said the aldermen weren't ready for it. So we need to, statewide, there's a tremendous lack of resources for harm reduction, and it's evidence-based, and it works, and it keeps people alive, and no one finds recovery when they're not alive.
Well, we will follow up on that point and a lot of the other others that came up this hour with you gentlemen at a later date. I'll close it out for now. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.